Getting started with our conservation webinar, I'm Holly Kirkendall, National Technology Specialist for NRCS's East National Technology Support Center. I'm pleased to turn the webinar over to our moderator, David Lamb. David is the National Soil Health Team Leader for NRCS's Soil Health Division. David, you may now begin.
Thank you, Holly. Again, this is David Lamb, serving as your moderator today, and it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dr. Jerry Hatfield, talking about the science that supports changes in soil health. And what an exciting topic we have before us today. Dr. Hatfield received numerous degrees throughout his lifespan here. He received his PhD from Iowa State University. He received his master's from the University of Kentucky and got his BS in agronomy from the Kansas State University. I won't tell him what year that is, Jerry, so
good.
Keep that just between us. He's served in various functions, working for the University of California at Davis. He started his career in ARS, and he's been lab director at the National Soil Tilth Lab since 1989 there in Ames, Iowa. And it's my pleasure to do that. I just really, folks, this is really an important topic because we've been involved with soil health 4, 5, 6 years, and all we get is, where's the science? Where's the science? And I think after today's presentation, you won't have to ask that question anymore because Dr. Hatfield is going to present some very compelling information as to why this is such an important topic and why NRCS is so adamant that this is the future of agriculture. So with that, Dr. Hatfield, I'll turn it over to you.
I wanted to start today, and I thank David and Holly for this invitation to share some thoughts with you, share some information with you about the science of soil health and why it's important for agriculture in terms of how do we look at environmental quality pieces, how do we look at climate resilience. All of these are terms that basically we see bantered around, but there's a little lack of understanding about just how all these pieces fit together. And as I work with producers, a lot of these things are questions that they have in terms of this overall process. I do put in my contact information. We'll leave time for questions and everything, but you have PDF of that presentation. So if you have questions after we finish the webinar, feel free to email me. We'll try to give you as much information as possible on this, or if you want background papers on some of these different slides that are shown, so you can have the full report of what's going on, feel free to ask. That's we're really here to try to transfer technology to those of you in the field that are really trying to use that and everything else. So I appreciate all the efforts that NRCS does in terms of soil health. And so we'll start off by talking about why soil health is important. I'll talk about the degradation process, I'll talk about the enhancement process, and I'll talk about the future demands of agriculture and why soil health is going to become a cornerstone in how we look at the future of agricultural systems and a number of different pieces on that. So starting with why soil health is important, just going to start with this. We're not going to show you a soil profile. I'm going to show you some data that we collected from Kentucky, Iowa, and Nebraska. And each one of those dots on that graph represents 40 years of county-level yield data. We didn't plot the error bars on those because the graph got a little bit messy. And so that's county average yield, and then we plotted that against the National Crop Commodity Productivity Index that you actually have in your database. And what you see is the higher the NCCPI value, the higher the average county yield. The lower the value, and there are a lot of those counties in Kentucky that the bottom or the lower yield on that is actually zero. They have complete crop failure in some of those years because of lack of rainfall. And if you look at the data in there, you begin to see one thing is one as we improve yields, as we improve the soil. And then there's that set of data from Nebraska. And Nebraska is not behaving like Kentucky and Iowa. And that's because we only cherry pick the irrigated counties. And so if you can supply water when that crop needs it, soils and soil quality doesn't have an impact on productivity. And, you know, it really depended upon what's available in that soil profile in the late growing season in order to make that crop yield the way it does. And so we see this in 2012 in the drought across the Midwest. We had very high yielding fields that were conservation agriculture. They had lots of water available to that crop. We had yields that almost pushed 300 bushels per acre in terms of corn. So soil quality and the NCCPI really does give us that viewpoint of just what soil is worth to us. If we look at it, we did the same thing for maize. Again, those are, we pulled the same counties out of Iowa and Kentucky. The better the soils, the higher the average county yield. And so you begin to see that, and then when we start looking across the Midwest, we just plotted the NCCPI values for the Midwestern states, the climate hub that I actually direct and everything, to look and see where those good soils were at, where the poor soils, how do we look at those pieces of the puzzle. You see that we moved from Indiana, Illinois, Iowa, parts of Minnesota, really have the high NCCPI values. You go into Missouri, they tend to decrease. You go into northern Minnesota, they're decreasing. One of the things that, from the whole climate perspective, is that we're seeing this movement of the Corn Belt north and west into North Dakota and South Dakota. But part of the problem is that we're moving those crops into areas that have poor soils. And so, you know, we're not going to expect the high yields coming out of that. So one of the primary things that we're working with is, you know, how do we look at individual fields? How do we look at this NCCPI value across the Midwest in all of this? And so one of the things that, and just to point it in a different way, you know, why this behaves the way it does, this is just a snapshot of a field. It's west of Ames. That graph on the picture on the left is from early August. We use a different set of indicators and looking at remote sensing. That field's fairly uniform. You can see some light spots in there. But then that picture on the right is 3 weeks later. It didn't rain in that three-week period. And I plotted on there what the yields were. That upper part of that field, the light-colored spots, 25 bushels per acre. The dark-colored area of that field, 65 bushels. So we lost 40 bushels the acre because we didn't have rain for a three-week period. And so we were reliant on what water was available in that soil profile. And so you begin to see the value of having increased water holding capacity in these soils, particularly during the grain filling period, and how that becomes important. We see the same thing. This is just a different colorized map. Again, we just colorized yield monitor data. The green area, very low yields, comparatively speaking. The purple area is the higher yields across that field. And again, those green areas are water limited in all of this. So what we're beginning to see across the Midwest is that having extra water storage capacity in that soil profile pays dividends in terms of our capacity to produce profitable crops, to begin to look at it from that perspective, and how do we look at this. We've got multiple pictures of that same field over time in terms of the yield, and we always see that those green areas are pretty stable across that, unless we get that perfect growing season, where we get the late summer rains that are out there.
Jerry, we've had several questions come in related to what NCCPI is, then some of the components or metrics that go into that measurement or index.
Yeah, the NCCPI, it actually is derived by a combination of soil depth, water holding capacity, the crops that's being grown, temperature and precipitation. If you go on your website, you can pull down the actual publication that derives the NCCPI and all of its forms and everything else. So we've been trying to work with the authors of that to continue to improve that, look at how that might change over time with more variable precipitation. But it's a combination of soil depth, water holding capacity, precipitation regime, a number of different factors that go in that. But the biggest thing is the soil water holding capacity.
Thanks. I think I helped clarify.
Yeah. Sorry, I just assumed everybody in NRCS knew what.
One quick reminder to folks, I forgot to mention this at the beginning. If you have a question, go ahead and type it in, and we're going to be kind of working throughout the presentation here, asking questions as we go along. And another question real quick, Dr. Hatfield, that does it only deal with non-irrigated, did the NCCPI only deal with non-irrigated, or does it,
no.
I know she had Nebraska up there by itself.
You can actually do it for irrigated soils as well. When you're supplying water, the soil water holding capacity doesn't mean quite as much because it's refilling the profile, but it does give you an idea of what it all fits together from that standpoint. So,
okay. All right. Thank you.
Yep. What we've been doing, because we have this fascination with why yields are varying both on an individual field and a county field or county level and then on a state level. And one of the things that we've been doing to look at sensitivity of crops to soils is the what we compute as a yield gap. And I'll just show you a couple examples here. This is maize or corn for Story County, Iowa. The solid line at the top is a statistically fit line, which really represents the optimum yields that we observe, what we call the attainable yield. We assume that there's really no weather limitation on that. The jagged line just below that is the actual yield that we observe coming out of NAST data. The dashed line below that is the yield gap, and that's the difference between the attainable yield and the actual yield. And so we can generate that, and we've actually generated it for all 677 counties for the Midwest for corn, soybeans, and wheat. But more importantly, what we've been looking at is that graph on the lower right side, and that's the fraction of attainable yield. If you start looking at what we have on attainable yield, how much we fall short of that, what we're seeing is that we're losing 20% of our yield about 80% of the time, and it's due to short-term stresses. Short-term stresses can be beginning of the season, end of the season. Just give an example of one at the end of the season. You know, we may project that our ET demand is roughly 2 inches of ET over a two-week period. We needed 2 inches of rain to refill that profile so the crop wasn't water-stressed. We only got an inch of rain. You look at that piece of that puzzle, and you really, as we work with producers, as we begin to change soils, improve soil quality, improve soil health, is we can begin to diminish that 20% yield gap because we make that system more resilient to just the short-term dynamics of what goes on in weather every season. And if you look at this, this is Christian County, Illinois. We did the same thing for corn. Yield gaps are going up and down. You know, some of that is due to like 1993, 88 in the terms of the drought, 2012 with the drought and everything else. You know, we look at that. We see the same thing for soybeans in all of this. So we're able to go back into records that are readily available. We can go in the soils maps for each of the fields. We just finished last night looking at these yield gaps relative to the NCCPI for each county, and again, only based on agricultural lands, and begin to look at the relationship between the yield gap and the NCCPI. And what we see is that, again, it's a the relationships are fairly consistent across states. You know, the poorer the soils, the greater the average yield gap that we see over time, because those soils are just more sensitive to weather variation. So we see that. We see the same thing. It's, again, the Christian County, Illinois soybean yield gaps are anywhere from 0 to, 15, almost 20 bushels per acre. And sometimes it's that 5 to 10 bushels or that 20% yield loss that we see is profit. That's what takes a field from being non-profitable to profitable. And so now we can start thinking about an economic value on soil health and what that means from that standpoint. The other thing that we've been looking at is an entirely different vein, but looking at what causes losses of in crop productivity, and we went back into crop insurance data, and this is from 1989 to the present across the Midwest. And what we see is, in the terms of the top claims, is that our top claim across the Midwest is excessive moisture and precipitation. That's not flooding. That's just excess, the drowned out spots and fields, the poor stands that we get because of too much water in the spring, oxygen limitations on the plant growth and things like this, and drought. And drought, particularly late in the season. So those two claims account for 55% of the insurance claims across the Midwest. So those really become part of how we would manage soils. And again, if you think about improving soils across the Midwest, here's another economic value of this in terms of reducing the riskiness in a cropping system due to too much precipitation in the spring. Part of that's due to aeration problems, a number of different things that go with that, drought late in the season. We don't get those big droughts. They tend to be much more of the subtle drought characteristics in all of this. That, again, it's that shortage of water that's there that causes a reduction in yield. And we see for corn, and we see the same thing for soybeans. Interestingly enough, that those two insurance claims, excessive moisture and drought, are the top two claims on soybean production as well. So, again, it puts a value back on what soil is worth. So, if you think about this, and you look at soils from a different perspective, built what I call the soil degradation spiral. And it started off with something that the top, that's poor land management, and you can put your own definition to what you think poor land management is. But one of the first things that we see change in that soil is the degradation of the aggregates. That upper half inch of that soil begins to change very, very rapidly. And so once we begin to see that aggregate degradation, so that soil begins to puddle, the aggregates are no longer stable, it's very susceptible to extremes, and that's what I have along the side in there. This is where we see a lot of crusting. One of the things that I've been telling producers, because they keep asking, you know, how do I know that my soil is in good quality, is go out after a heavy 2-inch rain or 2-inch rain and look at what the surface of your soil looks like. If it's all puddled and everything, you probably have very low aggregate stability. Means that you're very susceptible to runoff, water and wind erosion. Once we start eroding that soil, then we influence plant growth. Once you influence plant growth, you influence soil biology. Once you influence the soil biology, you reduce yield, and then pretty soon you wonder where productivity of that soil went. You go back to that one slide that I showed you with from early August to late August. Those poor parts of that field, you know, it's 40 bushels an acre lost across that just because we didn't have the water available. So the tougher part of that, it's very susceptible to extremes, heavy rainfall conditions, much more erosion coming on. And then the lower part of that is that that soil basically gives you that negative response to weather variation. And that's what we see with that 20% yield loss, because unless that weather is perfect, you're going to get nickel and dime to death in terms of productivity from that standpoint. So you just look at this in terms of these dynamics. And, you know, you look at this, I asked the question, you know, how much erosion is tolerable? These are just slides that we took in 2013 where we had lots of water in the spring, and then we turned off dry in the summer. These are all from Iowa. Upper left, I mean, you look at that, even below that green area, there's a lot of erosion in that. Down that side slope, there's a pretty big gully across there, a lot of sediment moving in there. And then the lower right-hand one is that we basically eroded everything down to the planter track across that. It's amazing that corn is still standing, and some of it isn't. But, you know, we look at that in terms of how much is tolerable. Here's a slide that Roger Wolf from Ohio put together, you know, just to characterize what 4 tons of soil loss means on a yearly basis. You know, it's only 25/1000th of an inch loss. But if you take over 40 years, that's a pretty big mound of soil coming off of 1 acre. So we look at that from that perspective. It's just like the soil degradation spiral. It accumulates over time. We erode those top parts of that field. You know, how do you begin to look at that in terms of the dynamics? The other piece that we need to realize is that this poor land management and this lack of aggregate structure leads to increasing wind erosion. That there's a stump at the edge of that, by that fence post. There's over 2 inches of soil that's been blown and deposited on top of that stump. If you look at that field, and we back calculated how much soil was along the edge of the field relative to that field size on there, that's about between 3 and 4 tons per acre of wind erosion loss just south of Ames, Iowa. And so, you know, you look at all this, you know, in terms of losing that topsoil, that's where we have all the good aggregate structure, used to have the good aggregate structure, all of this. So, you know, Iowa is not supposed to have wind erosion, but, you know, we're seeing it more and more just because of the changing climate that we have out there in terms of the overall processes. So this whole degradation process, starting with, you know, how we degrade aggregates, how we become more susceptible to water and wind erosion, how we have yield that begins to be more variable within fields, all of this, you know, really begins to change. And so then I built to help everybody understand what's going to take to grade soils to build them back up, is that we start that whole process by biological activity. That's the first step on this ladder that we're going up. And if you think about this, the mental picture is that degradation spiral is sort of like a slippery slide that it's easy to go down. The aggregation process going back up is like the Stairmaster. It takes work. It's going to take different processes. You're not going to slide back up like you slid down. But the first piece of that in terms of biological activity is that we build soil through biological activity, not by physical or chemical manipulation. Because we think about the biology, then we get organic matter turnover, then we get improved nutrient cycling. Those are what I call the invisible and dynamic processes that are going on. They're the things that happen within that soil. They have a lot of impact. And then you see the visible outcomes of that. You see the improved soil structure, improved aggregate stability, and then you see improved water availability in terms of the areas of the field not being as droughty at times and all of this. And at the end of that, you see increased efficiency of nutrient use. You see increased efficiency of water use by that crop. You see increased yield. And for the producer, you see increased profit. And so you have some very tangible outcomes of what that's worth in terms of this overall process as well. And so I want to spend some time just talking about biological activity from this standpoint. And we build biological activity first by creating a microclimate that's conducive to allowing that soil biology to express itself. Because you think about what soil biology wants. They don't want anything different than what you and I want. They want food, they want water, they want shelter, and they want a stable place to live. And so you think about that layer of residue that's on there basically reduces the extremes in which that soil goes through in terms of temperature. What it goes through in terms of moisture content, the role of that residue to absorb that energy of rainfall so that it penetrates through that soil, that residue layer in terms of modifying that temperature regime both on a daily basis as well as on a yearly basis so we don't see near the extremes, basically allows that biology to do its thing. Just like you and I, we really like a comfortable working environment. So that simple crop residue on the surface, we often think about just as being the carbon-nitrogen source for microbes, but in reality, it is that modifying effect on the microclimate that has the first initial step in terms of basically creating a home for that biology to work. So then you get into the whole feeding process. You can see that there's an earthworm in there. You can't see the bacteria and everything else. And then there's actually two other pieces to this. And I just separated into what we call a passive protective blanket and an active protective blanket. From the standpoint of changing the microclimate, cover crops, living residue on that surface has that same effect. They cool the soil. They prevent it from going through those moisture extremes. The passive blanket, isn't doing anything other than providing food and a cover on it. The active protective blanket has one other piece of that puzzle for biological activity, and that's a food source, a very active food source, because those biology are continuing to be fed because of the exudates coming out of those roots. We're extended a whole period in which we have an active root system into that soil that creates an entirely different home for that micro or for those biology to work. And if you look at this in terms of cover crops, one of the things we see is that the more diverse we have a cover crop cocktail, the faster the rate of change in organic matter content within that soil, basically because we're influencing the diversity of the microbiology that's in that soil. And so one of the keys to all of this is that we have a living soil, that this whole aspect of soil health, and that's why soil biology is the first rung of this ladder, is that we need to realize that it's a living soil system and that we need to be thinking about how do we satisfy that wants and desires of that living soil, and that, again, back to food, shelter, water, air, all of those things that you and I want in terms of a healthy environment is what we have here. And so this living soil is everything from mammals, you know, gophers, moles, mice, earthworms, down to insects, the microfauna, the microflora, cinnamomyces, bacteria, algae, fungi. All those different things are part of this overall process, and they're basically nature's plow. They're all of this, and I use the analogy that a really, really healthy soil has about the equivalent of two African elephants underneath that soil surface. And so you think about that. You know, if you got up every morning and you looked out over your yard that was an acre in size and there were two elephants standing out there, you know, those elephants are going to need to be fed. They're going to need to be watered. They're going to need to be taken care of. And, you know, we have that equivalent underneath the soil. So, you know, how do they get watered? How do they get fed? All those different things that are going on. So we need to realize that the cornerstone to soil health is really about how do we maintain that microclimate to allow the biology to express itself. So if you think about residue and cover crops, they're pieces of this. Is that they, first of all, stabilize the microclimate of that upper soil surface. Now, everybody complains in the upper Midwest that, you know, we can't have no-till, we can't have residue on the surface because that soil is too wet, it's too cold, all those different pieces that we see in this. But at the when we got a bare soil surface, we're very susceptible to not having those microbes in the whole biological activity having an adequate home to be able to survive. Residue and cover crops are a food source. They need to be fed. Just think about this for a minute, that if I only fed you 3 months out of the year in terms of a typical corn-soybean rotation, and the other 9 months you didn't get fed, you know, what would happen to you in terms of this overall process? And that residue and cover crops are a source of nutrients to be recycled. You look at all the nutrient content of crop residue. I mean, we've got tremendous pools of micronutrients, macronutrients, that the biology does a great job of being able to recycle in all of this. So if you think back to that ladder in terms of improved nutrient cycling, you begin to see this process going on. In fact, we've seen this in terms of the overall dynamics of this, and we just did a simple comparison. That upper line is a biological fertilizer. It's chicken litter. It's been mechanically composted to make uniform granules out of it. It has three different strains of bacteria added to it and everything. The dash line is Super U. It's a stabilized enhanced efficiency fertilizer, stabilized urea that we use, that's actually one of our better performers. What we got interested in was in the observation of how plants are responding during the grain filling period. And we measure leaf chlorophyll contents on a weekly basis, and what we're finding is that the biological material was increasing the length of time that that plant stayed green in late in the season. And in fact, what we see is that we just build a simple index about how long that plant was green relative to yield. The greener I can keep that plant, the higher the yield, because I extend the photosynthetic period. One of the things that we see in all of this is that it's because the biological activity is increasing the nutrient cycling late in the season. We see the greatest advantages in fields that have low biological activity, conventional tilled fields. We see a lot greater response in this than we do no-till fields where we have a high biological activity. And we begin to look at this, and we've run other experiments now that have confirmed that as we look at soil health, one of the things that we see is this aspect of nutrient cycling late in the season, and the yield component that's affected is weight per 100 grain. We tend to make a bigger grain at the end of the season because we've got the pushing of the photosynthetic activity towards that. In all of this, what we need to realize is that we deal in a very complex set of cycles going on between the soil and the atmosphere. We've got a carbon cycle, we've got a water cycle, we've got a nitrogen cycle. I'll just stop with those three, all driven by solar radiation. Those cycles are all overlapping with one another. We think about soil health in terms of these dynamics. All of those are there because in improving soil health, we're improving carbon. And then we improve water holding capacity, water infiltration rates. We improve the exchange of oxygen between the soil and the atmosphere. We improve nutrient cycling that is available to that plant, particularly nitrogen cycling as well. So all of these things begin to fit together. So it's not like saying, well, soil health is all about carbon or soil health is all about nitrogen. It really is these overlapping cycles that go on. And if you look at this, this is a graph from Tsai on a paper that he wrote and talking about the evolution of no-till systems. And I think this even applies to any conservation agriculture. And the reason I like this is it takes us through the initial phase and the transition phase and the consolidation and finally the maintenance phase, and you look at terms of years, is that in this initial phase, 0 to 5 years, is rebuilding the aggregates. This is the upper part of that soil surface in terms of how do we increase aggregate stability. And one of the key pieces in aggregate stability is really allowing that oxygen to be exchanged between the soil and the atmosphere. One of the reasons that we see excessive moisture have such an impact early in the season is that we're limiting oxygen exchange into that soil profile. And we see yellow corn, we see yellow soybeans, yellow corn, everybody thinks, well, gee, all the nitrogen is leached away. It's not about nitrogen leaching. It's really about the fact that that plant is starved to death for oxygen. And so you build this up, you increase soil density, you start stabilizing aggregates even more. And then finally at the end, you're talking about an accumulation of crop residue. Although the more I've worked with fields that have been in high-intensity systems is that we get a really active biological system. We have a hard time finding crop residue buildup. I've got some fields that have been in no-till for 15 years now that we're producing in excess of 250 bushels per year, and I have a hard time finding residue in that field by the end of June. So that's our biological activity in all of this. Why this becomes important is this piece of the puzzle. Just to give you an example out of Iowa, is that our precipitation is actually going up. That's the upper line. From 1895 through 2013, we've increased almost 5 inches over the total year period. But what's changing is that lower graph is that we're getting more and more of our precipitation in the spring. And these are coming as heavy events, more than an inch and a quarter a day. So we're getting very heavy rain, More of it's in the spring, disrupts farmer field operations, leads to compaction, a number of different things that are going on. And that's the climate signal that's occurring out there from having that impact. The other piece of this is, and this is just a simple plot of May-June precipitation, which we use as a representation of spring, versus July-August precipitation. Again, these are all the data from 1895 through 2013. And what I want to point out is that you look at those recent years, they're all on the fringe of everything we've observed. And so we're moving into a pattern of more variability of our weather between spring and summer years and what we've seen in the past. And so one of the climate signals and why soil health becomes so important is because of this increased variation of weather. Minnesota, still those values that we see in the last 5 years are laying on the fringes of everything, even though our distribution is a lot tighter in Minnesota than it was in Illinois. But here's the longer-term projection of why soil health becomes important, and that is that long-term projections, wetter in the winter, wetter in the spring, which we're already seeing that trend in there, drier over the summer for all the continental United States, including the southern part of Canada, and then drier in the Great Plains in the fall. And you think about this, is that basically we built our agricultural system on reliable summer rainfall. You look at the Great Plains, you look at the Midwest specifically, you look at the Southeast specifically, you know, we really rely on summer rainfall to produce that crop. And that trend is going down, but it's also becoming more variable. So soil health is really going to become very important to us in terms of being able to offset some of this variability in summer rainfall that we're observing. And the changing climate is going to also affect all of this cycling that's going on, because we're going to change temperature, we're going to change moisture regimes, all of these other things, and that's going to impact our ability to sequester carbon in these soils. It's going to change our ability to have nutrient cycling. It's also going to make it change the resilience to environmental changes out there, whether it be drought, whether it be root diseases, because one of the things that you see with increasing spring precipitation, more wet environments, potentially for more seedling disease and everything else. So when we talk about the science of soil health, we often assume we can change soil health without considering that we first need to use soil biology as a first step. And that initial rung on that ladder is, again, stabilizing that microclimate. And we have to realize that biology is linked to all the attributes we consider soil health: sequestering carbon, improved nutrient cycling, improved water holding capacity, improved aggregate stability. All of those are linked to the biological activity that goes on within that soil. And to put it in a different perspective, here's just the future demands of agriculture, what's going to happen in the future. We have a lot of information. You know, we talk about climate-smart agriculture. How do we build agriculture that's resilient to the climate changes that we're going through? The first step in that is building soil organic matter, either by minimum or conservation tillage. Soil organic matter is the third largest carbon pool on Earth. Means that we're going to have to integrate nutrient management practices, green manures, planting of legumes, livestock manure as part of that process, linking carbon with the nutrient cycle. That's going to give us ways in which we can improve water and nitrate use efficiency. We can't always irrigate because we don't have the water resource for that. So we're going to be reliable or rely on what we've got within that soil to withstand that. You know, how do we think about water management? And soils become part of that whole water management complex in all of this. And then we've got livestock management that goes with that, because a lot of our land area is in grazing and pasture. And how do we think about restoring that for soil health as well? But soil, climate smart agriculture, and we've been trying to make sure that everybody understands that, is dependent upon water and soil management practices. They're the foundation of how do we build climate-smart agriculture. Soil health, soil quality is a key to that. Because here is one of the other future demands of ag is, this is the graph from calorie needs, that light blue area on the right, from 2000 to 2050. If you really good at math, you find out that that dark blue and that light blue are basically the same area. It from the next 50 years, and now even less than that since we're in 2016, is we're going to have produce as much food over that 50-year period as we've produced from 1500 to 2000. And actually even a little bit more. And so it's really going to depend upon our soil resource to be able to provide that food production that we need. And on the same time, worldwide land availability is going to go down. It takes space to put 9 billion people and the infrastructure that goes with that. We tend to degrade a lot of our soils. We cover a lot of it up. That becomes a part of that. So it says that when to produce the crops that we need in the future, we need to make sure that our land base is there. To put it into perspective for you, we did a calculation the other day that by 2050, because of soil degradation, erosion, a number of different things, along with the infrastructure, cities, roads, et cetera, is that we're going to lose equivalent of two-thirds of the United States arable land around the world. And so that's a pretty big number in terms of thinking about loss of that. It means that every acre is going to have to become more efficient in doing this. So our challenge that we have and we try to look at is how do we enhance the soil resource through soil health? Mainly to increase water availability of that crop as a first step. How do we capture that variable rain that's there? How do we put it into a form that's usable by that crop? How do we increase the biological activity to increase organic matter cycling and nutrient cycling, begin that linkage between the carbon and nitrogen cycle? And to do that, we've got to create that stable soil microclimate at the soil surface that allows that biology to express itself. And then we also got to think about how do we protect that soil against extremes in climate. Seeing more and more heavy rainfall events that occur, that we have these very intense storms, and that's a signal that's occurring across the United States. 6-8 inches of rainfall in a 24-hour period leads to a lot of erosion. We see runoff events occur with less than an inch of rain, even a gentle rain at times, because our soils are so fragile. So we have some challenges, but we also have some great opportunities, I think, to work with producers, with their conservation plans, a number of things that you all do through NRCS in terms of this, to help the producers understand that improving their soil does improve their capacity to produce a crop, to reduce their exposure to the variations of weather that's coming on, improve the profitability of their crops, a number of different things that go with that. So with that, David, I'll entertain questions, and I see a lot of them have come in. So
yeah, there's a lot of them here. I'm trying to cherry pick the ones that we can respond to. Thank you, Dr. Hassel. That was I could sit here and listen to you all day. I'm going to kind of take you back to the beginning there. This attainable yield, what exactly is that? I mean, are you cooking the numbers there? What's that all about there?
Now, would I ever cook the numbers? No. Actually, what that is it in statistical terms, that's the upper quadrant analysis. What we do is we just feed that data into SAS. We tell it to fit a line through the upper limit of the yields. So that represents the frontier of those data points. You notice that line just touches the upper points on that graph. And what we use in all of this when people compute yield gaps is sometimes they use potential yield. And that's the genetic potential of that system under completely non-limited conditions. That becomes a very loose number because you don't know how all of the things work. we go back to the attainable yield and say attainable yield is the yield that we see when things were relatively optimum throughout that whole growing season. And you see that there's probably 5 or 6 points on that NAS data that probably represents that upper frontier.
So that's more realistic. And you're telling me that 20% of every year, 80% of the time, most fields have a 20% yield loss because of lack of moisture.
Yep. It's short-term water stresses.
That is pretty amazing. So tell me, how does managing soil health, improving this whole thing about aggregation, how does that improve my chances of recuperating part of that 20%?
That's a great question, and it's really a twofold aspect. If we maintain stable aggregates, we increase the rate of infiltration into that soil, and so we get a lot more movement of water into that soil profile, so that we can increase the capacity to store water within that because we're not running it off. The other thing that it does is that those aggregates also improve the oxygen exchange between that plant and the atmosphere, so that we're not stressed when we get to the very saturated conditions, so that that plant's more actively growing and taking up water, cycling nutrients and everything else. So that combination of things really improves water use efficiency. We see a much greater water use efficiency in fields that we have greater aggregate stability because they that plant is just functioning more efficiently. It has better root proliferation, better growth, all of those different pieces of the puzzle. Because if you do the flip side, we see that if that soil puddles very quickly, we're not infiltrating water anymore. Thing about liquid water is you can't stack it up, it's going to run somewhere. And so we move it off of fields. Once we move it off, we don't get it down into that profile. So,
do you have enough, in NRCS we use curve numbers to predict runoff when we design our practices. Is there any estimate out there how much you can affect runoff by improving soil health rather than, we tend to deal with the after fact rather than try and prevent it. So have you all done any work related to that?
Yeah, in fact, I've been back through trying to work with your soil attribute database where you've got physical number, where you've got the sand, silt, and clay content, you've got all the water holding capacity of different soils. Go back and redo some of the things that Hudson did in the mid-90s, looking at the organic matter content, soil organic matter content relative to water holding capacity, and then begin to put it, put it into this whole thing with curve numbers, runoff rates, infiltration rates, things like this. So that's a piece that we're working on right now. So
okay.
There's about 250,000 observations in that database that we're trying to sort through right now. So
okay. The idea of managing temperature, we all talk about cool, wet soils in the spring, but we don't think about the other side of it. Can you talk a little more about how healthy soils help to mitigate or regulate that somewhat?
Healthy soils, if you think about the temperatures in all of this, that when we get a very, very stratified soil with, a crust layer or a compacted layer near the surface, is that we tend to have a lot of those soils get very warm near the surface. They almost become discontinuous in terms of the rate of heat exchange going down through that profile. The more stable or the more aggregated we can make that soil, the more uniformly it warms up near the surface because of thermal conductivity, a number of different things that go on from that standpoint. But the biggest thing in all of this, and we're working on it right now, is maybe we're trying to warm our soils up too quickly, is that if they warm up more slowly, slowly we reduce the rate at which we see mineralization, which is a biological process, all those different things going on. And so looking at it from a standpoint of managing temperature and water, and particularly in this early season dynamics, is not something we've paid a lot of attention to. You know, we kind of assume there's cold, wet soils. But if we take a look at what we have in the microclimate of soils, and all we have to do is move that residue away a little bit, like strip tillage, that soil is warms up just as quick as if it had been bare for the last 2 weeks and everything. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we can do about residue manipulation to create a seed zone that isn't as cool, and we change all these different dynamics to go on. So I think we've got a lot to learn about how do we manage residue early in the season to create that zone for that plant to grow and yet not threaten, not have a negative impact on our aggregate structure because we're over-tilling at that surface.
You use this word aggregate a lot. Can you kind of give us a brief description of what that is? And then I'm curious how far down into the soil profile can we actually change soil aggregation?
The aggregates, most of the time that we see the aggregates are right near that surface, that upper inch of the soil, and that's where you see the real effects of biological activity. That's where it's the biological activity takes, and that's the glue that holds that sand, silt, and clay together. You think about one of the tests that's often run in soil health is the wet aggregate stability test. You know, you take soil out of the field, put it into the thing of water, and you see how quickly it dissolves and everything else. Well, you think about that's what that soil is being exposed to during rainfall events. And so when you look at it from that perspective, once that soil begins to puddle, then we reduce the infiltration rate. We create that crust over there. And it only takes a 1/32 of an inch of crust to limit water vapor exchange, gas exchange between the soil and the atmosphere. That soil, once it becomes consolidated, is a pretty effective barrier. And so the better we can keep that aggregate stability, it's that little crumbly pieces of the surface, the better we have all these exchanges going on, water coming in and continuing to come into that soil. That's why we need the residue on the surface, is basically to break up that raindrop energy. Because if we think about that heavy rainfall, that residue layer getting down through there, if we don't protect that soil, then that raindrop energy is beating on it. It's basically a very aggressive wet aggregate stability test. But if we can use that residue or plants, you see it during the summer, is that, you know, foliage above that surface is absorbing all that rainfall energy. You don't see near the puddling, late in the season as you do early in the season, where we don't have much protection across that surface. So, those why I say go out and look at what happens in the spring under 2-inch heavy rainfall and see what that surface, that soil looks like as a real measure of soil health.
Two more questions and we'll let you go.
Okay.
You talk an awful lot about Iowa here. What if I'm down in Georgia raising cotton and peanuts? Would I expect similar impacts like you were showing with your corn and 80%, 20% thing?
Yep. Yeah, in fact, we're looking nationwide right now on a lot of that. We would actually see that maybe your yield gaps may be a little bit larger than the 20%, may go down to about 30% because the summer rainfall pattern, is a little bit more variable. Your soils have a little bit lower water holding capacity. But where we've looked at yield gaps in different areas, we see that similar trend as well. We're trying to look at this from cotton is one example. peanuts become a little bit different because, you know, it's very aggressive in terms of digging those peanuts out at the end of the season. You know, how do you put those into a rotation that would build soil health up, you know, prior to that peanut crop, and then how would you be able to manage that in that? So we're looking at that and keep extending our analysis out, because one of the things I really want to do, David, is put together an economic value of soil health across the United States for different cropping systems, and how can we build climate resilience into this. And one of the things that I haven't talked about, just because of time, is the effect on diseases in this, because we start getting these very saturated soils early in the season, and we see that then, you know, really it makes a little difference whether we're in Iowa, Georgia, Florida, California. You know, we get saturated soils that are cool, we tend to have a lot more disease issues in our cropping system, and so that becomes another part of this puzzle that we need to be thinking about. How do we look at these dynamics?
Well, Rodney Rulin, a farmer in Indiana, says his soil health is worth, I think it's $90 an acre, $100 mm-hmm. an acre, and which he farms 6,000 acres, so it's making him $600,000 a year. So that's, and he's got some pretty compelling numbers if anybody had a chance.
Well, I tell you, that's I'm glad to hear that number, because I've been telling people that it's worth somewhere between $75 and $80.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to see that I've been conservative on that number. So.
So, well, listen, I appreciate, I could go on and ask more and more questions, but we've run out of time, and we need to let our audience go and those, and we'll turn it back over to Holly here in a second. But, again, I appreciate your insights, and this has been a most informative presentation, and I just appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. I want to remind folks that this is the second webinar in our soil health webinar series this year. On March 8th, we're going to have another ARS representative, Dr. Alan Franzubler, is going to talk about integrating grazing into cropping systems. On April 12th, we're going to have one of our new soil health specialists, Doug Peterson, talk about grazing management on CRP acres to improve soil health. So we've got a pretty dynamic outline of webinars coming up. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to you, Holly, for a closeout and instructions on how folks can get their CEUs.
Okay. Thank you, David. And it's been a pleasure working with both you and Jerry today to present this webinar presentation. Thanks to all participants for joining in. I noted in the Q&A message that we had more than 600 people join today's webinar, so that was quite a training crowd for you, Dr. Hatfield. Participants, to provide your feedback about the webinar, and if you selected to earn CEUs, please return to your open browser window to continue the process that's offered by Step 2 at conservationwebinars.net. And because there were quite a number of logins, the page could load a little bit slowly, so please be patient as you do so. And that concludes our webinar presentation. Thank you all.